Hello and welcome to The Monocle Weekly, episode 165, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
In today's show, we sit down with the curators of a film festival with a very specific remit, based on the cinematic output of one man better known for his music, David Bowie.
We look at the long history of the con man in American culture as we talk to American author Amy Redding about her book, The Mark Inside.
And we catch up with Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Cavallo to talk about Pierre Cardin's gift to the people of Venice, a skyscraper.
Plus, we'll look at the Indian ska scene, that's right, the Indian ska scene, and take a look at the forthcoming week's news and enjoy some great music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So we pull the reins back, we pull the horse's head up, and we're almost over the last jump, we're almost home. Or are we in the ditch, Andrew?
Well, it's obviously Sunday and we should have finished the issue by now, but I think we've got the last couple of pages to send for the new issue.
I can still hear some clip-clopping in the stables. Not all the horses have bolted.
Not all the horses are kind of tied up for the night. I think there's the odd culture nag still out there.
Oh, God, I know.
They're hard to get back in the corral, those culture nags, aren't they, Mr. Bound?
Some of them are a bit knackered. I mean, we thought we'd buy all new fresh horses for this next issue. I don't know how long we can get. Let's get rid of this metaphor.
Let's keep it.
You like? No, you're, no, we, cause, you're just basically having a go.
Because look, who's just come in? A fresh stallion.
Hi, Tom Edwards.
Hello.
Tom Edwards said
to me this week, he said, "Don't tease me this week." Really sad. Said, "Don't tease me this week."
I thought this was going to be sad. "Don't tease me this week." And what did you? And you said,
"He's a stallion." Yeah. But I think that's quite nice.
That's kind of positive.
And that is positive.
That's upbeat. I feel.
I still very much
now.
Think of Tom Edwards as one of the sort of fresh young stallions in the Monocle stable. Actually,
yes.
Huh. How's that feel?
Sort of vigorous type.
You had the look on your face of a man that sort of thought I was going to then take it back with another comment.
I was waiting for that, to be honest. But I'm glad that.
Anyway, you're off to Italy later on.
That's right. Yes, I'm heading off just on Tuesday.
Just on Tuesday.
What were you reading that off? Something very tiny, like the side of a cereal box.
It's my internal diary.
Your diary. What are you doing? Yeah. Is that holiday or is that work or pleasure, Tom?
It's just pleasure.
Okay, good.
Pure, undiluted pleasure.
Phew.
It's called the Amalfi Coast, I hear.
That's right. They wait till they get a load of Tom Edwards.
So what does that mean? Naples and things?
I will be in Naples for a short
time. That's very nice.
Time.
Would you like me to tell you where the best pizzas are?
I would love to know that.
Oh, I'll write it down, but let's not do it on air.
Oh, but then our listeners miss out.
Okay. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, that's why. We got to the bottom of this. See?
It's €3. It's the best thing. It's called the Crudiola. And the only bit that's cooked is the base. And it's just fresh mozzarella, fresh basil, and fresh tomatoes. And pomodorini as well. Small cherry tomatoes chopped up. Delicious.
I may never come back.
Yeah. I've got some good bad news for you. Naples on Tuesday.
Let's meet for a semi-cooked pizza together.
Yeah, exactly. It's not semi-cooked. It's just
and a bit of limoncello. That would be good.
That would be nice. Oh. Is that what you have? Is that what you?
No, I'm not going on holiday with
breakfast.
Tom.
Oh, are you not?
No, I asked if I could go. He said no. I thought I'd go anyway. No,
work-life balance.
Me and David Michon are going there. We're going there for the UN Habitat conference.
Oh, nice.
It's called Work.
I was going to say that sounds. I think we should whip back to that later in the show and see if you're still excited about it. By the way, Tom, is you telling us that you're going to Italy on holiday? Is that your news preview?
Yeah, it's finished.
The agenda. Call it the agenda.
I was creeping out already.
Okay.
Do you want something else?
This is the bit of the week where Tom Edwards tells us what's going to happen in the rest of the week.
Exactly. A few little surprises out of left field as well. You know,
you're going to say it in that kind of weird, stilted way that you delivered the fact that you were going on holiday in?
No, that's
I'm not. Going on holiday on
just
Tuesday.
On Tuesday.
I just might on do, Tuesday. Just on Tuesday. I don't know what that was about. I was curious.
You were reluctant.
No, it's all right. We're in the spirit of it now, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I thought we'd start with our global agenda in the far-flung city of Vladivostok, where later today the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation will be meeting.
Man, that's boring. What's that?
Set your sights.
Come on, not
higher.
Everything.
should we just leave that one there?
No, it's great.
This is a very important organisation.
I did like the fact that they've built. They kind of built a special building all for it. That's going to be handed over to the local university when they're finished.
Absolutely.
Is it the shape of a rocket?
It's kind of based around a bay.
It does.
It's not like within a volcano that opens and the building comes out. It's not that exciting.
Okay.
It's not. It was not being constructed by some kind of fiendish Bond villain.
So tell us again the title of this conference.
The Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. It's the premier economic organisation for the Asia Pacific region.
I think they'd get more guests if it opened up like a Bond lair. A Bond villain.
Well,
lair.
I keep writing to them, and so far, I think I've just been blacklisted now.
Okay. So that's cool. And who rocks up to that? So it's being hosted by Russia and Vladivostok.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's the Japanese, and are they presumably the two big players in that region?
Well, it was established by 12 economies in 1989, including the United States, of course. 2.7 billion consumers. Seven of America's top 15 trade partners are involved.
So your heart's not in Vladivostok.
Not really.
No one's ever sung I Left My Heart in Vladivostok. No, Vladivostok. Tony Bennett has never sung a song.
But it's a key. This is one of the big coming cities internationally.
Is it?
Very significant. The border, you know, Russia, as Russia integrates itself more closely with a lot of its Asian colleagues instead of looking always to Europe, these kind of meetings will be of fundamental importance.
Next.
Where are you going on holidays, Vladivostok? Next.
Well, that was my Tuesday entry was holiday time.
Okay.
So we'll brush past that. Okay. What about on Wednesday?
Yeah, what's happening on Wednesday?
Here's one that might appeal to you.
Tom will be putting on his shorts.
Yeah. Spanish state.
Factor 30.
Spanish.
Don't forget the back of the legs.
60.
Bit pink on the shoulders.
Oh, absolutely. Spanish state-owned television will be screening a bullfight on Wednesday.
Yeah.
After a six-year hiatus. Now, obviously, extremely unpopular in some quarters, very controversial, quite a divisive issue. Is it a key part of, you know, the heritage of the nation? Or is it a sort of, you know, barbaric throwback to sort of the Middle Ages? But TVE, which is the state-owned public service broadcaster, is going to be showing a bullfight, which will be held during the Feria de Valladolid. And there'll be a number
during
of...
During the what?
Feria de Valladolid.
Matt, I'm glad he's not going to Spain on holidays.
That's pretty good.
I'd hate to see the kind of state of the hire car if that's what your Spanish is like. Sorry, Tom. No, I'm sorry. This is a very interesting issue. I think it's very. This is TV España, which is that. So this is a bit. This is a big deal because normally it would be possibly one of the cable channels, one of the kind of pay for channels.
Absolutely. Well, it became something. You know, it was marginalised the whole sport.
Yeah.
Or people attempted to do that as the mainstream lost its appetite for it. But I think quite a significant moment. It'll be interesting to see what the sort of Spanish public make of that.
I think it's a good thing. I wonder what commentating on a bullfight's like. Because that's kind of a skill, isn't it? For the Olympics, we've got the Paralympics on that right now. For the Olympics, lots of people who did one sport had to sort of learn the rules and regulations of about three other quite minority sports.
It'd be a real challenge.
Would you like to commentate on that, Tom?
A bullfight?
Yeah.
I went to a bullfight.
Yeah.
Once. And
they didn't ask you to commentate because you can't order a hire car in Spanish.
Exactly. That was the acid test, which I failed magnificently. Went down in a blaze of indignity.
That's nice. That's a good roundup, isn't it? Light shade. Spanish accent, and we in Vladivostok, we cut Vladivostok's forum down to size.
Exactly.
And the very final question, I've never seen you in a pair of shorts. Do you own them for your holiday?
Of course.
I'll see you on Tuesday.
That sounds sinister, doesn't it?
That sounds very
with
sinister.
With a camera.
Tom, thank you very much for your look ahead at the week's agenda.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, cool. And happy holidays. And what are we doing next, Andrew?
Well, next, I think we're going to be finding out about Mr. David.
I think we're talking about the Bowie Fest. He is perhaps the UK's most iconic, prolific, enigmatic and beloved musical artist. David Bowie has been a part of our musical heritage seemingly forever, influencing countless groups, single-handedly inventing genres only to kill them off and move on, and was heavily referenced in both the opening and closing ceremonies of the Olympics.
But he's perhaps less celebrated for his work in front of the camera than the microphone. Well, this week in London, a film festival at the Institute of Contemporary Art celebrates all things cinematic from The Thin White Duke. And we're joined by two of the curators, Natasha Dack and Ollie Harbuttle. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. First of all, Natasha, why did you decide to do this festival?
Well, we realised that it had never been done before, so that seemed like a very good reason. We met at a film festival in Toronto about a year ago, and we were just talking about ideas for other niche film festivals that we could put on in the UK, and we realised we were both Bowie fans.
And tell me, you know, his career as an actor, which was quite successful, and quite, you know, everything from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. You know, actually, there was a period when he was quite well known in cinema. Was that something that was a first love of his, do you think? Or do you think it was just a kind of adjunct to him doing the music, something that followed on from him being a singer?
Well, I think if you look right back to the start of his career, he was acting then, and he, you know, obviously the mime thing was going on as well. So he also was a stage actor too. He was in The Elephant Man on Broadway for a while. So I think it's something that was running in tandem with his.
And I guess it's part of his thing, isn't it? It's part of the dressing up box. His whole thing was the dressing up box. I guess that kind of followed its way into film fairly naturally. But his films are quite odd. I mean, he worked with Nick Rogue. He worked with kind of people that, and Julian Temple and people that are kind of like part of that musical music heritage. Is that something you guys wanted to sort of tap into as well? It's a very London thing, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, I mean, some of those directors are fantastic directors. I mean, I don't think that governed our decision. There were other films such as The Hunger, which the recently deceased Tony Scott, that was his first film, and films like Christiane F. So it wasn't limited to London. I think there is a good range of films on offer at the festival. But I think the directors who really did identify his talent do have this kind of musical leaning. And Nick Rogue's shown that with other musical artists, of course, such as Mick Jagger and stuff.
And I wanted to ask about the kind of, it seems that Bowie as an actor is sort of much more stripped bare than he is as a performer. As a performer, there was makeup, there was the costumes, there was the hair, there was, as we said in the introduction, there were the personas that he invented and then killed off. You sort of see, do you think you see more of David Bowie in his films than you do, not just as a naked alien in The Man Who Fell to Earth, but do you think you see more of him than you do on his records?
Yeah, well, I think when you look at the roles that he's chosen, a lot of the time he chooses to play outsiders. You know, I don't know if that's an insight or...
Yeah.
I think it's very hard to identify the real Bowie, though. I think in film or in music, he remains an enigma, and that's one of his biggest draws. And even that might be more stripped down and there's less manoeuvres for kind of outrageous costumes, etc. He just retains the Bowie-ness. But whether that's the real Bowie is for up to us to decide.
Obviously, across town, the V&A Museum, they're also planning kind of retrospective of his career and work. Do you think, you know, this is, for some reason, this is an important time to kind of take stock of what his career was? Do you think there's a re-evaluation of his work?
I think this year's been quite pivotal. It was his 65th birthday in January. The 40th anniversary of Ziggy Stardust was in the summer, so I think that's why he's kind of come to light again. But his legacy has never really gone away, and I think he is a national treasure, so that will always be the case.
Okay, you've chosen a couple of tracks to play to punctuate this chat. Can you tell us what the first one's going to be?
Sound and Vision from the Low album.
Low, and this was okay. Well, we'll hear the track, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit about it and about what he was doing at the time it was recorded. This is Sound and Vision from Low. And that was Sound and Vision from Low. So tell us why you chose that one. Did you choose one each, by the way? Because we're going to play a couple.
Yeah.
All right, so who's this?
It was an almost impossible choice.
Yes.
Of course, but it was my choice. And I really like this album, Low. And actually, my two favourite songs are this one and Always Crashing in the Same Car, which follows this on the album.
Yeah.
So it was the first album from the Bowie in Berlin era. And he sounds quite low. I mean, if you listen to the words... He sounds quite lonely in it, so...
Yeah, this is where he went to Berlin. This is Low Lodger Heroes, I think. Berlin. And he went to sort of Berlin to escape the New York club scene and drugs and booze. And then Lou Reed, Iggy Pop moved over with him.
Iggy Pop with him.
A man who clearly might not help you get off those things. We like. And he made these records. And Low is a kind of, it's sort of, half of it's a sort of like an electronic rock record, and half of it's quite instrumental, isn't it? The sort of side two of it is quite lyric-free zone. And there's a lot of kind of synths in this. It's quite a sort of satisfying, punchy, loud record. Is that your favourite Bowie record, Low?
No, actually.
You don't want to be held down to anything, do you? Because you love him too much, you don't want to make any decisions.
No, actually, I think the first album I ever bought when I was a kid was Scary Monsters, so I think that's got special place.
It's No Gay. Is that It's No Gay?
Yeah, Fashion, Ashes,
yeah, yeah,
yeah,
Ashes. Yeah, which is great. Off those. Okay, and Ollie, what did you choose?
I chose Moon Age Daydream from the Ziggy Stardust album, which has always been my favourite track. And in the 40th anniversary of the album, I thought it was a good choice. And we opened Bowie Fest, pardon me, on Friday with the Ziggy Stardust documentary by Pennebaker. So it seemed like a relevant choice.
Okay, so that was Moon Age Daydream, I'm an Alligator, I'm a Mama Papa Coming For You. And we probably have to address Labyrinth, don't we, Andrew?
We do. You ask me what you're addressing.
Because it was, you know, sort of a respect to my Merry Christmas, Sister Lawrence is one of my favourite films ever. And Labyrinth is, I think David Bowie's probably been asked himself about this. Is this a hit or a flop in the David Bowie movie canon, guys?
Absolute hit.
Yay, see, there you go.
That was actually the first film I ever saw at the cinema. So
It
really left quite a lasting impression. Codpiece has been imprinted in my mind ever since. So for me, it's a very important film. I mean, the response to Labyrinth, you see midnight screenings of the film pop up all around the world the whole time, and there's just a huge following. And it's slightly ridiculous, it's very camp, but I mean, I think it's a decent film.
And that was a period when David Bowie, that was sort of mid-80s, yeah, wasn't it? And that was a sort of period where David Bowie was sort of, was it a slight fallow period? I mean, I guess Scary Monsters was sort of early 80s. Yeah. But he didn't sort of do much for a while. And it seemed that it was almost kind of like riffing on, it seemed to me that he was sort of riffing on sort of, he was a bit Ziggy Stardust, but he was also a bit of an alien. And of course he had that fine codpiece, Ollie. But do you feel that it was a sort of idea of like slightly playing with his artistic legacy in a movie like that? Playing a version of himself?
Yeah, I think so. And also, you know, if Jim Henson comes along and asks you to be in a film, you're not going to say no, are you?
Well, I don't know. Do you imagine? Do you want to be Fraggle Tuck? What do you think?
I think I've been that before, actually, on more than one occasion.
And things like Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, these were kind of like slightly more, well, they were slightly, again, I guess they were slightly more of an art house thing than obviously the Jim Henson stuff. Mm. Is this sort of generally considered to be one of his, you know, the finest film? I mean, in terms of his acting and his persona, and sort of maybe for the first time really getting away from his role as a musician.
Yeah, well, Bowie himself has said that it's the performance that he's most proud of. I think it's an excellent performance in that film.
Well, because we've kind of squabbled about what our favourite Bowie tracks and albums and films are, I'd like to sign off with one of mine. This is Here Comes the Night. And for the time being, Ollie and Natasha from the Bowie Fest Festival at the ICA, thanks very much for joining us on The Weekly. Closing her eyes and telling them lies exactly like she's told me to. Oh, here it comes. And that was Here Comes the Night, Andrew Tuck from Pinups, which is, I think, one of my favourite Bowie albums.
And they were saying that they hope to take that Bowie Fest on the road. They're heading to New York and also to Toronto.
And to Berlin.
And to Berlin too.
Yeah, all the places apart from Toronto that David Bowie's had fun in.
Well, how do you know he's not had fun in Toronto?
Have you? No, it's great. I'm sure it's a great place. It is a great place. I've had fun there. I've been to a wedding there. I've been to all sorts. I've had all sorts of hijinks in Toronto.
He says, anyway. He says rowing back very quickly. Okay.
Not rowing back. By the way, Pinups is his 1973, I think it's his 1973 album, which is all cover versions. So when it's like, what's your favourite Bowie song? And he's written sort of a million great songs.
I think that you could actually be on Mastermind for David Bowie.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. Wouldn't mind it. But you've got us. It's Bowie.
I just said that.
What happens with Bowie?
See, I was just testing you, testing you to see if you corrected me.
You're literally narrowing your eyes at me.
As Paul Noble, our producer, said before we came on air, it's Bowie as in snowy.
Yeah, this is like, it's like meeting the Queen, isn't it?
Yes.
All right. Anyway, in a minute we're going to be speaking to the author of The Mark Inside about America's greatest con man.
Marseille, renowned for its multicultural makeup and hard edges, is a city being reshaped. To discover the beating heart of Marseille, Monocle Films visits three hoteliers who reflect the evolution of this heady Mediterranean city: Au Vieux Panier, Le Petit Nice, and Hotel Le Corbusier.
I always used to say that we are here to share our passion. Here we are so proud of the building, so emotionally attached to the work of Le Corbusier that we are proud of it and we want to share it.
Marseille in Motion. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. The American history books are littered with tales of iconic swindlers, card sharps and con men. In 1919, J. Frank Norfleet lost everything he had in a stock market swindle. He did what many other marks have done before. He borrowed more money and returned only to be conned again. But, unlike other marks, when he lost a second fortune, Norfleet took control.
he vowed to hunt down the men who had conned him.
Armed with a revolver and a suitcase of disguises, Norfleet travelled from Texas to Florida to California to Colorado, posing as a country hick and allowing himself to be repeatedly ensnared to gather evidence on his enemies. And in 4 years, Norfleet was nationally famous for his quest to outcon the con men. In her book, The Mark Inside, Amy Redding gives us the story of Norfleet's ingenious reverse swindle, and she joins us on the line now from Ithaca, New York, to talk about this. Amy, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, this sounds amazing. This sounds kind of like a, in the third act, it sounds like a movie script in the third act. It's a courtroom drama. How on earth did you uncover this amazing story?
I uncovered the story when I was writing a very, very boring dissertation in American Studies. And the dissertation had one exciting chapter, which was about autobiographies by con men. And I was extremely interested in hearing what con men would say when the time came for them to tell the truth. How do they reform and stop lying, which is their life's profession, and actually come clean and tell how they worked the trick for so many years. So that's what the dissertation was about. In the course of that, I came across this autobiography by a mark, by a victim of con artistry, and it was so incredible and such this amazing larger-than-life adventure that I was absolutely certain that it, too, was a kind of con, that it was written by perhaps a con man or someone who was just enthralled with the genre and who really wanted to enter into the game in a literary way and was pretending to be a mark and pretending to have been conned. And I did a little bit more research and found out it was all true, and then that just set me off. That was just so amazing that this actually happened in real life.
So, Amy, just tell us Norfleet's quest. Was it to kind of get revenge, or was it just to understand what happened and try and warn other people? Or was he also out to make money himself?
Well, all of the above, but over time, these various goals kind of evolved. So first it was about revenge. He was absolutely outraged that he had been so violated, and this really did go to the core of his values as this Texas rancher, that he had had everything taken from him. And during a business deal which he conducted with a handshake, and his handshake was his word of honor. So initially it was about restoring that sense of honor. Along the way, he became very interested in not only catching his swindlers, but also catching anyone that he came in contact with. It became this kind of quest that he was going to clean up America, and he was going to try and educate people along the way. His quest became very famous early on, and newspaper articles followed him wherever he went, and so he did a fair amount of educating. But then along the way, his values began to drift, and he became so caught up in the underground world of con artistry and so adept at conning the con men, at fooling them by putting on disguises and going into the con, that his values began to look a lot more like the con men themselves. And he actually became a lot more interested in money than in revenge. And there's one moment in the story where he meets up with his nemesis, Big Joe Fury, the ringleader of the con men who had swindled him. And he's got him in handcuffs, and he's ready to take him to jail. And Fury offers him money to let him go free. And Norfleet accepts. And that's not the end of the story. Lots of other things happen. And I'll just say that he doesn't actually get that money. But there's this moment where his moral radar kind of quivers, and his values kind of shift a bit because of his immersion in deceptive art.
I love the idea of a quivering moral thermometer, don't you, Andrew? That's straight away. That's a filmic sort of image. Amy, this is the kind of idea of the con man, of the good man gone bad and the bad man gone good and gone bad again. Whatever happened to Norfleet is sort of something that's ingrained in American literature and American film. It seems that for this sort of thing to exist and to be believable, you need a country as large as America with its sort of its hugeness and ambition as well to sort of sustain this kind of this con trick and righting the wrongs that were done to you, I guess. What makes it such an American thing?
Well, first of all, I would say it is deeply American, but I would argue that it's not exclusively American. So, you know, we definitely have an obsession here with the idea of the self-made man and of someone who has created not only their wealth, but their whole persona from the ground up. And there is something about this speculative nation, this nation that grew up as a kind of act of faith, I suppose, that that lends itself to invention all the way down to the core. But I would also say that you find an interest in conning, and you find these characters and these mythologies and these real true life historical stories in any culture which is a market culture, in any culture which is based on relationships of commerce and relationships that are fundamentally issues of trust, which can then of course be exploited in all different ways.
And we think of, I've got sort of romantic images in my mind of Steinbeck novels and of kind of Don Draper, these kind of things that are halfway between fakery and self-invention, which are kind of very attractive. It seems like something that, or the romance of that seems something that was sort of, has sort of stayed in the past. When we think of kind of the modern, you know, the Wall Street, the people that have pulled the wool over people's eyes on Wall Street and things, it seems far more sinister, doesn't it? Do you think it was a more innocent age, or do you think simply dressing up with a number of disguises is a bit more of a hucksterish kind of way of doing it?
Oh, that's a really good point. I think we're very safe in holding up for adulation or cultural fascination these historical figures, right? And so we can all watch, say, The Sting with Robert Redford and Paul Newman, and they're the rascally con men, and we like them. We admire their cleverness. And I would also point to the Ocean's 11 franchise, right? We're all rooting for those bad guys. But then when something like Bernie Madoff comes along, he's absolutely the scapegoat for all of the sins of the 2008 financial crisis. And, you know, he is, there's nothing heroic or clever about what he did. He's just flat out a bad guy. And I think that's because that's a little bit too close to home, and the parallels between what he did and what was happening in the financial sector at large are just a little bit too close to home. We can't really find any redeeming values in someone like Madoff. So we go to the movies and we resurrect someone, as you say, like Don Draper, perfect example.
And Amy, we were talking there about the idea that this is incredibly filmic, the story. There's something about it that begs to be made into a movie. Is that something you've already thought about? Have you begun to offer it to film companies? Are you thinking that this could be a TV series, a good box office hit?
I will say only that there have been some conversations. There's no deal in the works yet. But it is very filmic, and it's amazing how many people ask me that question, and they immediately think of this story and think of it on screen. And to me, that's really interesting. I mean, it's a good story, but why couldn't it just stay on the page? Why do we instantly sort of think of it as a movie? And I think that's because we have a lot of movies about con men, that this idea of someone who just takes on the entire world, just is willing to lie about everything. It's such an audacious act, and it's so, we can admire it, and we can also be horrified by it. At the exact same time, we can hold those two complex feelings in our minds as we watch this character. That is a character that we see in lots of different movies, and, you know, there are lots of movies about con men and even any kind of shysters or hucksters or advertising men, as you say, and that is definitely one of our favorite, I think, filmic archetypes.
But Amy, you did actually write this book. That's the truth, isn't it? I'm getting confused now.
I'm telling you it's a true story, but you have to trust me. You have to believe me. I think there's a lot of similarity between what I'm doing in the book and what Norfleet did in his life and in his memoir, and a similar parallel between what he found when he went after his con men. It's all about telling a good story, stringing out the suspense, the timed release of information to have your listeners or readers feel exactly what you want them to feel at exactly the right moment. So you're right to ask the question, but yes, I did write the book.
I'll send you my bank details later on.
Oh, perfect.
Amy Redding, author of The Mark Inside, thank you so much for joining us on the weekend.
Oh, thank you. I love it.
Thanks a lot. That was the breathless Amy Redding.
I loved her.
I love her. I love her enthusiasm for the Mark Insight, and I like her voice.
And I like somebody who's enthusiastic about what
it was. Yeah, it's
and when you've written a long, serious book, it must be quite hard to be light and jolly about it.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to do that.
I'd want to lie down on the sofa, I think, if I'd written all that.
Lie down on the sofa and read it. That's what Sundays are made for, Andrew.
Perfect.
You know that.
Perfect.
Stay tuned to the Monocle Weekly. Coming up next, we're talking skyscrapers.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Adjutuck, and Robert Bound. Well, you know how it is. You get all excited about giving a loved one a present, only to find out they just don't want it. No one likes to have a gift go unappreciated, whether it's a pair of ear warmers or a 2.4 billion euro skyscraper.
Though we might think of him as the epitome of French style, the fashion designer Pierre Cardin was actually born in Venice and at 19 years old wanted to leave a gift to his native city, a 250-metre tall modernist glass skyscraper housing a fashion university, luxury hotel suites and shops. But rather than unbridled enthusiasm, the proposed 2.4 billion euro project has been met with everything from healthy scepticism to open ridicule. Joining us on the line now to discuss this is Ivan Carvalho, Monocle's Italy correspondent. So this sounds like a bit of a monstrosity. I mean, I guess this was unveiled this week at the Venice Architecture Biennale. It's going to sit in that city. What's been the chorus of approval or disapproval in the Italian press?
Well, this 256-metre tower is seen as you mentioned, it's quite a monstrosity. It's something you might imagine seeing in Dubai and not in Venice. To be fair to Mr. Cardin, he was born just outside Venice and left Italy when he was two, it's going to be located in the industrial port area. So he's saying to critics that, look, you can't see it from Venice, so, you know, don't get all excited about it yet, you know, give it a chance. But, it looks something like a Martian might have built and just parachuted down from space. And so right now he's using the Architectural Biennale as a way to, on the sidelines, to promote this and say, look, you know, everyone's talking about architecture. This is something that's interesting. It's also a job creator. But a lot of people in the preservation groups are not happy about it.
And can I ask you, Ivan, there's obviously a quite serious point here. How do you develop an Italian city, especially like Venice, even when you're away from the core? Obviously, you don't want to put up a kind of Jetson-style skyscraper, but do you think there is a debate to be had about actually what would be acceptable in the port area and other areas, you know, on the fringes of the city?
I think it's a fair question to ask because, you know, Italy is in a recession, and Cardin is offering to pay the bulk of this project. So he's offering upwards of €1.5 billion, and it will be a job creator from what he says. And afterwards, there will be shops, hotel, and also luxury apartments. Whether or not this is what Venice really needs, it's hard to say. Ideally, it might move some of the cruise ship traffic out of the Grand Canal, because as a lot of people know, these cruise ships come into the center of Venice, and that also sort of the scale of the city is thrown off by these massive cruise ships. Maybe with setting up something outside the city, that might help. But, you know, again, people don't like these sort of radical interventions of architecture. Santiago Calatrava built a small pedestrian bridge near the train station, and that has seen people up in arms for years, complaining about the design. There wasn't any accessibility for people in wheelchairs. This thing, of course, is quite large, and so obviously the controversy is going to be going on for several years. Whether or not he can really sell the job creation point to people, it's going to be hard to see.
And it's kind of one of those, it's kind of a thing that rolls on. I guess the Architecture Biennale is a great time to have this argument of, as Andrew's saying, how to kind of stoke up a bit of, you know, newness in a city that kind of that plays on being old and pretty. Is this a problem that's sort of Italy-wide, of putting anything that's vaguely contemporary in any place of sort of historical interest?
Definitely. For example, let's take Florence, another city, great historic value, a lot of tourism. In the center of Florence, you know, they had a long fight to bring in a tram service to remove car traffic so that pollution would not damage these historic buildings. A lot of debate there went on for a long time. You know, it's not easy. You know, it's difficult when you have these fabulous buildings that have been around for centuries, but at the same time you have to address the needs of today's residents and also visitors who do bring in important income. The tourist traffic at Venice receives about 2 million tourists a year from the passenger ships. So you can't ignore that, because the residents themselves are diminishing in Venice. There are fewer residents than there were, say, 10 years ago. And so, you know, it's a delicate balance, and these discussions are going to be ongoing, because, you know, Italy has a lot of these great UNESCO sites, protected sites with great architecture. And to protect them, you know, it's going to be an ongoing debate.
And you know, obviously you sit in Milan most of the time for us. Is that a city that you think is perhaps the best example of, you know, an Italian city able to kind of cope with a bit of modernity?
Definitely. In Milan, skyscrapers are not a problem. Just now in my neighborhood, I've seen being built a skyscraper that's going to be occupied by one of Italy's biggest banks, UniCredit. Sort of take them out of various offices spread out all over the city into an area that's under development with lots of apartment towers, office buildings, residential, some very innovative projects that we've even discussed on our design show with lots of trees and sort of this vegetal facade with lots of plants and bushes to make a sort of green sort of environment. And in Milan, it's easier going. You know, it's an industrial city, so the architecture, you don't have as much of these great sites that you maybe have in Rome or Venice or Florence. And so there is a bit more, it's a bit more easy to sign off on projects for Archistars or even though in Italy it's funny that a lot of the Italian architects tend to go abroad to do their big works.
Well, thank you, Ivan Cavallo. Thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. Normally in Milan, in Venice, I think, this week, Andrew. What do you think about that? I kind of think Venice needs something like that to make you realise how beautiful the rest of it is sometimes as well.
It needs something like Ivan.
Yeah, just a giant, 256-foot Ivan. Ivan the Terrible.
That'll make them rethink their lives a bit, won't it? What the hell is that? That's Monocle's correspondent.
There he is. It's like the attack of the 256-foot Ivan Cavallo.
I'm just looking at the picture of Pierre Cardin.
Yeah.
He looks damn good for 90.
I haven't got that picture.
Hey, look, there he is. He looks like...
Oh, yeah.
Well, he looks well.
Do you think he's 90 there? Oh, yeah, it must be, because that's with the tower. That's a crappy building, isn't it?
It is. It's like, I'm afraid that it was drawn in the 60s. I think he found it in a drawer.
It looks like something. It looks like the sort of dystopian tower block that J.G. Ballard wrote about in High Rise. It looks like in the 1960s, when that novel first came out, that would be the illustration on the cover.
Yes.
With some sort of smoke coming out of one of the windows and a chair and a dog being eaten. as happens in the first line of the book. But yeah, Pierre Cardin, great-looking man. That's a terrible building.
Yes. Sorry, Pierre.
Sorry, Pierre. stick to cufflinks. So what's coming up next, Andrew?
Scar.
Indian Scar, more precisely. Stay tuned. And you are tuned to the Monocle Weekly. Ska music grew out of the ghettos of Kingston, Jamaica in the 1960s, and with its blend of angry energy and socially conscious lyrics, became the music of choice for disaffected youth in Thatcherite Britain. But the music form is now finding new audiences in India, thanks to a determined group of reggae and dancehall fans who got together to bring ska music to the subcontinent. The Ska Avengers have been performing around India for the past year and a half, finding popularity in a country where classic rock holds sway. Here's Monocle's correspondent, Arti Bertigeri, with more.
We're from New Delhi. The belly of the beast, it is my home. King of the jungle, I sit on my throne. Represent for black and the brown, thin and the slim and the fat and the round. They could never understand my psyche. Don't like Reebok, I don't like Nike. We don't walk on the moon with Whitey. Only walk with the Almighty. Rhythm track! I think ska music is much more akin to the Indian social and historical experience than rock music or white rock music is. The East Indies and the West Indies, you all used to be a part of the same colony. So I think there are a lot of connections which make sense musically as well. The form is Jamaican, but the content and the way we represent it here is very much Indian. It's very much Indian in terms of the things that we talk about. Now, ska music, rocksteady music, dancehall music have a long tradition of social commentary, of commenting and reflecting the social reality around us. And that's what we represent here as well.
Baby. A few years ago, New Delhi's live music scene was pretty flaccid. The best you could have hoped for might have been an Eagles cover band at the Hard Rock Cafe. But things are far different now, and that's partially thanks to the Ska Avengers, a ska band that burst onto the scene last year with a vengeance. Dressed in sharp black and white, the six-piece outfit brought style to the stage and original lyrics to the microphone that, importantly, were socially relevant. The band's songwriter is Taru Dalmia, who goes by the stage name Delhi Sultanate.
Let me tell you about the forests of Dandakanya, where the trees reach the sky. What do you know about the Rela fruit from Amalta's trees, yellow like sunshine? What do you know about the Gondi tribes who never knew about rape, murder or crime? They never deal with no money, never deal with no market, and never follow digital clock time. Never deal with the
I grew up with reggae and dancehall music, and it politicized me at a young age, and I started reading people like Frantz Fanon and Ashish Nandi, which really led me to question how things were, you know, how society was organized around me. Started asking a lot of questions. Reggae music encourages this. Reggae music is subversive, has always asked questions. So I think it kind of came from there. It deals with reality, and the reality that's unfolding in India and other parts of the world slowly is something which is very grim. It's kind of hidden from mainstream news, and mainstream culture does not focus on it. A lot of things are going on. I mean, what you see slowly in India unfolding is a low-intensity kind of war. There's an armed guerrilla movement in many parts of the country. There's peaceful resistance. There's a very insidious nexus between corporate interests and corrupt political institutions, which are, in my opinion, basically continuing a older colonial legacy of extracting resources and of exploiting the environment and the people of this country.
The band's first album is out in October, and already they have a solid following with firm street cred for their social conscience. Apart from gigs in bars, clubs and private diplomatic parties, they've played at a fundraiser for a doctor jailed for treating Maoists, at a book launch for prominent activist writer Arundhati Roy, and most recently inside New Delhi's famous Tihar Jail. That gig happened after the band's founder, London-born Stefan Kay, was jailed for 3 weeks earlier this year over a visa transgression.
I spent most of the time in the music ward teaching or doing music workshops. I decided that I'd spend the time constructively, and there were some decrepit instruments. There's a drum kit, there were some guitars with some strings missing, some really cheap microphones and a crackly amplifier, and there were some traditional Indian instruments, like dols and dholaks and harmoniums, that kind of thing. So I was helping some of the prisoners with drums and guitar and keyboards. I did make a pact or a vow with one of the prisoners who had been there for 4 years as an under trial, and I told him about the band, and I said how we must come back for New Year and do a concert, even if I'm not out. So I made a proposal, sent it to the Director General, who is Niraj Kumar, and he was kind of interested, and it looked like I was going to get out. So I made a vow to bring the band and help with replenishing the music equipment, because a lot of new instruments were needed and a lot of instruments needed repairing. So this I made my prerogative after I got out.
That gig gained the band and the jail significant international attention, although Stefan points out that that's not why they did it at all.
We feel guilty that generally we can only perform in venues which can only be attended by the affluent few, the top 5% of the population. If we can expose our music to more people, then that's great. The kind of people who can't afford to spend 300 rupees on a bottle of Tuborg, which is not premium beer by any stretch of the imagination. Many of the people who we think would like our music would probably not get admittance to most of the venues we play at, even the ones that are free.
The album was completed a year ago, but the band struggled to find a record company bold enough to take them on. It's envelope pushing music for India, where popular culture very rarely ventures into touching upon social ills. So it will be interesting once the album makes it to MTV and commercial radio to see just how Middle India deals with lyrics about class warfare and paramilitaries. But based on the response of audiences at their live gigs, it's likely to be good. For Monocle in New Delhi, I'm Aarti Vetchagiri.
Ah, oh, the sun sets, Andrew, on another Monocle Weekly, 165.
I'm not that quite that old, but thank you. I'm not getting there.
I'll tell you what, we should... You're going to have to stop getting a tattoo for every show, like you promised on show one, because I'll tell you what, you're beginning to look like the illustrated man.
best guest?
I really like... I liked
we can
Amy.
Be brutal.
I liked Amy.
She was nice.
She was cool, wasn't she? She was rock and roll. I like someone that's written something and can talk brilliantly about it. As you said, you might want to collapse on the sofa after all that effort. But I like how she wants to go out and sell it.
And it's quite nice that she found it while doing a dissertation. Because you think, actually, most people who do anything doing a dissertation, that's kind of like the kiss of death. It's that really...
That's just lying on the sofa.
That's like... You would definitely lie on the sofa if you publish a dissertation. You wouldn't think, ooh, I can chat to people about that.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's the point of doing it, isn't it? To find something interesting and then make some money out of it halfway through rather than just nerdling on pointlessly.
Did you do a dissertation?
No. Haven't you read my culture lead for October?
That is your dissertation, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's good.
That's very good.
Yeah. I don't actually know whether you have read it.
Well, I've skimmed it. I've got to read it one more time because it wasn't quite... You hadn't quite
let
filed...
Let it sink in.
No, you hadn't filed it. That's why. there was a bit missing, a key bit missing.
Oh, okay. Right.
But I was very pleased to see you managed to... out of all the Lusophone nations, you managed to send yourself to Brazil.
Yeah, thank you.
That must have been really tough, Bob. Oh, should I go to Cape Verde Islands?
That's
should
quite
I go
nice.
To the Azores?
Happily. I'd have gone on to either of those places. Luckily, doing a Lusophone themed issue, there's no short straw.
No, and also you've also quite clever that you found people to interview in both Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro.
Well, you've got to have a you being the editor of Monocle more than anyone should know that you've got to have a proper geographical spread.
Well, next time, Oporto and Lisbon.
Okay, that's Lisbon in Portugal, not in Ireland.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, not Lisburn.
I'll let you go as far as the Iberian Peninsula, but that'll be about it.
Well, thank you very much. So thank you to all our guests on today's Monocle Weekly. Thank you, Andrew.
Oh, do I get thanked now?
Yeah.
That's quite nice.
Well, I know, you've had a long week. I have too, but you know, I think yours has been, you've had more to read than I have.
I've read a lot.
Don't worry, as soon as you read that Brazilian lead... It'll be like having a lie down on a sofa. It'll be like having a massage. Anyway, we should thank also today's producer, Paul Noble. But for me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.